Hello, it is Ryan, and I was on a flight the other day playing one of my favorite social spin slot games on ChumbaCasino.com. I looked over the person sitting next to me, and you know what they were doing? They were also playing Chumba Casino. Coincidence? I think not. Everybody's loving having fun with it. Chumba Casino is home to hundreds of casino-style games that you can play for free anytime, anywhere, even at 30,000 feet. So sign up now at ChumbaCasino.com to claim your free welcome bonus. That's ChumbaCasino.com and live the Chumba life.
No purchase necessary. VGW. Void or prohibited by law. See terms and conditions. 18 plus.
Hello, it is Ryan, and I was on a flight the other day playing one of my favorite social spin slot games on ChumbaCasino.com. I looked over the person sitting next to me, and you know what they were doing? They were also playing Chumba Casino. Coincidence? I think not. Everybody's loving having fun with it. Chumba Casino is home to hundreds of casino-style games that you can play for free anytime, anywhere, even at 30,000 feet. So sign up now at ChumbaCasino.com to claim your free welcome bonus. That's ChumbaCasino.com and live the Chumba life.
No purchase necessary. VGW. Void where prohibited by law. See terms and conditions. 18 plus.
It is Ryan here, and I have a question for you. What do you do when you win? Like, are you a fist pumper, a woohooer, a hand clapper, a high fiver? I kind of like the high five, but if you want to hone in on those winning moves, check out Chumba Casino. At ChumbaCasino.com, choose from hundreds of social casino style games for your chance to redeem serious cash prizes. There are new game releases weekly, plus free daily bonuses. So don't wait. Start having the most fun ever at ChumbaCasino.com.
No purchase necessary. VGW. Void where prohibited by law. See terms and conditions. 18 plus.
Hello everyone, I'm Ben Johnson and this is the Perpetual Chess Podcast. On Perpetual Chess, I have weekly conversations with the chess world's best players, promoters, and educators about their lives, careers, current projects, and best practices. For more information, go to perpetualchesspod.com.
Hey everyone, so I'm here coming in from Berlin with freelance writer, fresh off of writing an outstanding profile for The New Yorker on Levon Aronian, Sean Williams. How are you?
Good, thanks. Good to speak to you, man.
So this is a little bit, Sean obviously is a little bit of a different guest, but us chess aficionados like myself and the listeners, we love to see chess portrayed positively in the mainstream media, especially in illustrious publication like The New Yorker. So Sean, could you tell us a little bit about how this profile on Levon Aronian came into existence?
Yeah, sure. So I was actually initially looking at kind of the more political side of the chess kind of infrastructure, you know, stuff going on in with FIDE and in Kalmykia and some interesting stuff like that. And I kind of decided to go along to the World Blitz Championships in Berlin. I think it was in 2015. But while I was there, I kind of, Levon took my eye because he was such a kind of languid looking guy at the board. And I just kind of loved the way that people were really drawn to him as well. I mean, I have to admit, I didn't really know a huge amount about him at that point, but I was kind of enthralled by the way he carried himself and I was interested to hear more. So yeah, I kind of did some research and through that I kind of found, you know, how important he is for his country. And then through that, I kind of discovered all sorts of interesting things about Armenia. So it just kind of snowballed from there.
Yeah, it was one of those sort of classic New Yorker sweet spots where you tell a smaller story that sort of encompasses some bigger stories dating back to the Armenian genocide and the chess history of Armenia. But you had a keen eye for someone who fascinates us. So just a couple of weeks ago, we had Hikaru Nakamura, who's also one of the world's top 10 on, and we asked him, I asked him who he thought had the best chance of supplanting Magnus Carlsen. And funny enough, he mentioned Levon Aronian and talked about him in sort of the same terms that you did in your profile. So whatever it was about him, you noticed something accurate. So how did you, once you decided that he was an interesting figure, what was your next step, Sean?
Well, I mean, I'd always had kind of a fascination to go out to the Caucasus anyway. So I was like, okay, this is my perfect opportunity to kind of make that, a real trip. So I headed out to Yerevan last summer it was, and kind of spent about 2.5 weeks in the region and just met a load of people within the kind of chess system there, kind of young people playing it in bars, even, you know, going to the kind of chess federation and meeting a load of people there and going to a couple of tournaments. So I kind of got into the chess scene in Armenia that way. And while I was there, I met Levon at a hotel in kind of downtown Yerevan. And it kind of even meeting him there kind of summed up a lot of things about the country and chess, because we kind of met in this big cavernous sort of fancy hotel that's kind of an emblem of how the country and the city is kind of getting over a lot of its past problems. So everything was very emblematic about meeting him and doing the story, and it all seemed to click into place there. Yeah.
Okay. So as a freelance writer, Sean, were you just taking this trip on spec, and or did you already have sort of a gig lined up for where it was going to be published?
Actually, so the way that I worked this trip was a bit strange. So I actually did, to kind of get out there in the first place, I did a travel story based in Georgia. And so Georgia abuts Armenia. And I was kind of going on a whim that I would sort of see some interesting stuff chess-wise in Armenia. And I'd spoken to my editor at The New Yorker that I might kind of find something, but it was kind of half on spec and half through another story that I got out to the region in the first place. So it's a bit of a sort of strange way in, but yeah, it got me there, and it kind of got me ingratiated with the locals and allowed me to kind of do some more research firsthand.
Excellent. And we'll get back to the story, but what was your entry into chess? How did you know about the FIDE clusterfuck, for lack of a better word, the general background?
Yeah, I mean, I played it as a kid. I played chess in school for a bit. I'm useless, completely useless. I don't know. I mean, I was looking to do more sporting stories because I seem to have fallen into this pattern with The New Yorker of writing about the kind of nexus between sport, culture, and politics, which I really enjoy doing. So I had been to Moscow to do another reporting trip, I think, a while before the Berlin tournament. And I kind of just sort of tested the water and spoke to a few people there. I spoke to Garry Kasparov at one point as well to try and see if I had an angle to write about him related to FIDE. So I mean, I couldn't really tell you exactly how the story came about or how I was sort of slowly became more and more obsessed with the idea of writing about chess, but it was kind of a slow burner for a few years. And once I kind of got it into my head that I wanted to write about chess, then I was reading all sorts of stuff and going back into the history books and, you know, getting really excited about writing about Cold War stuff and all kinds of historical aspects of chess. So when I did finally settle on writing about Levon, it was a kind of relief in a way.
Yeah, a little bit more contemporary, but you were still able to weave the history into it. So once you got to Armenia, was your first step, did you go to a chess club, or what did you do to start digging into the culture there?
Well, I kind of went high and low. So I went to the Chess Federation, which is at this kind of crazy wedge-shaped building on the outskirts of Yerevan, and then met the local sort of Chess Federation secretary. And he showed me around a load of stuff, and there was a kind of senior tournament going on there that a lot of the local players were attending. So then I kind of met a few of the local players there. And then I think one of the first nights I ended up wandering into a bar that was called Chess Pub. And that gave me a really interesting insight into how kind of prevalent it is in Armenia, because these guys were getting completely screwed up on shots and playing kind of speed chess in a bar, playing heavy metal rock music. I mean, it was such a shame that it kind of got left on the cutting floor of the edit, actually, this scene where people are just playing chess at a million miles an hour. There's chess pieces flying all over the floor. Everyone's getting hammered. And I think the blackboard outside the pub said, what was it? It said something like, life is serious, but chess is more than life, or something like this. So it was kind of a really nice insight into how widespread the playing of the sport is there and how kind of passionate people are.
That must have been fun. So did you dip your toe into Blitz or mainly spectate?
I mainly spectated. I kind of played a few games, had a few shots, and kind of got into it there. But yeah, I mean, I wasn't a patch on even like the 10-year-old kids that were playing in that place. So yeah, that was also another crazy thing. There's kids all the way up from sort of young kids up to like 70-year-old guys playing each other in this bar. So and I wouldn't have a hope at taking them, you know, more than 15 minutes, any of them. So I kind of just was happy to sit back and watch and have a beer or two. But it was a great experience. Yeah.
Yeah, well, these days there's 10-year-old kids who can beat almost all of us, myself included. So there's no shame in that.
I'm beating myself up. Yeah.
Yeah, exactly. So, and then I'm going to kind of go back and forth because I want to get to your meeting with Mr. Ronian and getting to interview him a little bit and getting background. But so when you took it to New Yorker, were they just like on board right away or did it take some convincing?
I went to New York and I met my editor at the New Yorker and to be honest, no, it didn't take a lot of convincing. I think that it had all of the, by the time I'd kind of knew enough about the story, it did, like you said, it had this kind of perfect feature element, like the kernel of the story and the profile of the guy himself that kind of explodes out into all of this, history and culture and sport and stuff that you can really kind of, diffuse out in the story in a way that's really enjoyable. So I think they were really into it from the off. I think it was commissioned within like a day of chatting to them as well. So that was nice because that process can go on for a while sometimes.
Nice. Yeah. And so once you decided to dig in, did you find like the jargon of chess? Did you find it daunting?
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah, I thought I knew something about chess, but I realized I knew absolutely nothing when I started to research the stuff. But I mean, it's just a case of like picking up the right books and just putting your head down for a while and really kind of concentrating. Actually, incidentally, that's something that I find really interesting about chess that I'm useless at. I haven't got a huge sort of attention span, and I find the discipline of playing chess at that high level is so fascinating because it uses a part of the brain that I don't seem to be able to access ever. The way that these guys can kind of just hunker down and focus on tournaments and winning all the time. I find that really fascinating. But yeah, back to your point. I mean, at the start as well, I just kind of like flung as many emails out and was on the phone to as many people as I could, just trying to get as many different viewpoints on the game. And it was really fascinating, really, really cool, interesting topic to research.
Nice. Well, hopefully, this won't be your last piece on it. So you mentioned that you read some books to sort of get acclimated. Do you remember any particular books that were helpful in sort of, breaking down the barriers of our little subculture?
Now that's a good question. I read some of the titles by Bobby Fischer because I found out they were quite interesting. As a kind of historical look back at some of the big clashes there. Mm-hmm. Apart from that, I mean, I read a couple of Garry Kasparov's books as well. But I tended to delve into, I can't remember now, there's like dozens of different sort of small, obscure books that I read. And Google Books was great for that. They've got so many chess books just available online that you can read.
Oh, nice.
Yeah. But honestly, as far as specific titles go, no, I can barely remember which ones I was looking at the time.
Okay. And digging into the story, I mean, the lead of the story is awesome. Just like Melikset Kachian, I hope I'm saying his name right. He's a well-known teacher here in the U.S., but I unfortunately may or may not have the pronunciation down. But, you know, him ending up staying with Levon Aronian's parents and... Mm-hmm. becoming his teacher and Levon sort of exploding within a few years from there. So how did you nail down that bit of background information?
I think that I may have got I think it was from Levon himself. He was telling me about Melikset and then once I contacted Melikset, it was kind of, that part of the story is really, really lovely to begin with. And it kind of plays into so many different narratives about the country at the time, which is going through two of its kind of biggest disasters, the earthquake and the conflict, which still hasn't died down at all. It's interesting because it plays into another narrative that unfortunately didn't make the final story, which is that the Armenians themselves are quite concerned that a lot of their coaches are moving abroad to the States especially. And they're worried that this is creating a bit of a kind of brain drain in where to teach the next generation of players. Because despite being such an overachiever in the sport, Armenia doesn't really have any kind of top performers in the mold of Levon still. So I think a few people are quite concerned that people like Melikset and others are heading abroad to kind of get more money, and that's leaving a bit of a gap in terms of where the next big star is going to come through.
That's interesting. And you mentioned in the article that, that teachers have historically received state support, but I guess it can't compete with private enterprise here and elsewhere.
Yeah, I mean, it's. I think the stipend is something like, even for a grandmaster, I mean, it's just like a little helpful bump of money. I think it's like $120 or maybe $200 or something, but it's not, it's certainly not enough to, yeah, sustain any kind of professional career, you know, in a huge way. So when the big bucks come, then I think most of the guys are going to get on the plane.
Right. Which, yeah, that, I guess, I mean, I see both sides of it. People have to pursue their self-interest, but, you know, mm-hmm. The outliers in terms of chess history, like Armenia and Iceland and places like that, we wouldn't want them to lose their character and their strength.
Yeah, and I mean for Armenia in particular, so much of their national ambition is wound up in this sport that I think it would be pretty devastating to them if they kind of lost that status.
Yeah, and you mentioned that their current president has a chess background.
Yeah, he was president. I think he still is the president of the Armenian Chess Federation. And he played a big role in kind of welcoming Levon back into the fold when he was self-exile in Germany and was going to switch allegiances. He's kind of played a big role in bringing chess to the kind of population and making it a compulsory part of school education, which is really unique. Unfortunately, I couldn't speak to him for this story. His spokesperson kept kind of fobbing me off, which was annoying because I thought he would have provided some really good color for the piece. But I guess lowly freelance reporter wasn't good enough for the president this time around. So it was a shame. But he has played a huge role in kind of bringing chess to the fore as a way that Armenia can really help develop its youth. And that's the whole huge part of the story. Touched on really that's fascinating about how chess can help Armenia overcome a lot of its kind of economic woes, which I would love to write about again.
So Sean, you may not have been able to access the president of Armenia, but you did get some great people. Like you had an amazing quote from Anish Giri, sort of poetic about Levon Aronyi, and he said he's probably too emotional referring to winning the world title, and the sight of his dream being close makes his vision blurry. So how were you able to gain access to some players like Giri and get so much sort of great background?
To be honest, when you kind of flash the New Yorker brand at people, they're a lot more willing to talk to you than maybe when you're speaking on behalf of other publications. But I was also kind of really, really surprised by the candor of the top players. I thought they'd be quite tight-lipped about their opponents, but they're quite ready to kind of... shit around. Yeah. Not necessarily in a kind of bad mouthing way, but just being very honest. And I found that really refreshing, having spent a lot of years speaking to soccer players and other sports stars who are kind of really tight lipped and pretty bland sometimes when it comes to quotes. So, yeah, I spoke to Anish Giri and Wesley So contributed. And I spoke to Vishy Anand as well, and he was great at talking about how he thought that, you know, Levon was a wonderful talent and really sort of precocious, but was very mercurial and was probably losing sight of what was making him great. So, yeah, it was really, really interesting to speak to those guys. And obviously they're total stars. So that was quite a privilege in its own right.
Yeah, I've noticed that about the top players as well. And I think part of it might be that, the media glare. I know you've written about soccer, or aka football, of a fair amount. And I think the media glare is just a little less bright. And the other thing is just that they know each other so well that I think they maybe don't feel like they're telling tales out of school if it's like they see each other basically at every tournament.
Yeah, I think that's right. And I think that because of the kind of the more intellectual side of the game as well, I think that they have a lot more mutual respect for each other than maybe people in other sports have. Because they're always on tour together, I guess they're always hanging out. And so, yeah, it certainly makes for a better story as a journalist anyway.
Yeah. And this tournament, so, I mean, this feature took you to, so you spent a lot of time in Armenia. Obviously you live in Berlin where Levon Aronyi and also, lives part of the time. Did you, go anywhere else for this story?
I met Levon at London after the event there, just before Christmas. I'm from London originally, so I was actually there to visit my family for Christmas, and it turned out that he was there at the same time. So we met after the tournament at the hotel in kind of central London, and he was pretty despondent at that time. And it seemed to kind of bookend what had been a pretty dreadful year for him. And I think he took to Twitter or Facebook after that to apologize to a lot of his fans and assure them that he was going to come back this year. Yerevan, London, and speaking to him on the phone in Berlin. We haven't actually met in Berlin yet, but I'm sure we can find time in the future. His schedule is all over the place, so who knows?
Yeah, I remember that post that he did on Facebook. So you'd say, like, after that tough tournament, you could really see it in his mood?
I think that's when my vision for the story, not just for him to be a figurehead for the country, but really how psychologically that pressure is really, really weighing down on him. I think that's when I first began to think that that could be the kind of lead way to kind of speak about his character. And then subsequently having spoken to him after that, when he'd kind of spoken to his fans and I think had time to consider things, really once I homed in on that angle, it really became clear that that was something that really is unique to him among many of the top stars. Even though, you know, players like Carlsen and Vichyanen really don't have many domestic competitors and they're really representing their nation, I don't think that anyone has quite the same level of, you could almost call it a sort of national fervor or desperation for him to win in the way that the Armenians, I mean, every person I spoke to, from sports journalists to regular guys down the restaurant or a bar, they're really, really pinning a lot of hopes on him. And he knows it. And I think that it, you know, it could provide a lot of strength for him. But sometimes I think when he's down, because he's such an emotional, mercurial player, I think it really bogs him down as well.
Wow, that's interesting insight. And he comes across as a very likable player. I'm friends with, some grandmasters who are able to appreciate the quality of his games and, you know him a little bit. And I think that he's got a disproportionate number of fans, even amongst the sort of other top 100 players. There's just something about him that other players are drawn to.
He's just a real character. He's not really playing a role. He's not trying to be something that he's not, and he's not trying to be happy, sad, angry, or whatever, just for the sake of trying to build a brand, so to speak. He really is quite an eccentric guy. And I think that really shines through. Like, I don't know how to describe it. He's not an excessive guy. He's not really over effusive or overly emotional in any kind of way. When you speak to him, he's very affable and friendly and really kind kind of guy. But I think he's very genuine. I think that's something that shines through in interviews with him. And I think that's why people are so into him as a star.
Yeah, there's a dichotomy there because, you know, you describe the emotion of his play and the sort of fire that burns within in him. But he's known as more of the well-adjusted players amongst the players in the top 10 or 15. I mean, in order to make it to that level, you have to sacrifice so much and focus so much on one thing that a lot of the players are not necessarily fully present in like daily encounters, but that's not the rap on him.
Well, I mean, no other player has the kind of local celebrity that he has, I'm sure. When you go to Armenia, if he steps out in the street, people would, you know, be on him. But in a really good way, like a really tight-knit, kind of friendly way. And I don't think many other players have that rapport with the nation. And I think he likes to have his own time and he doesn't spend a lot of time kind of out and about in Yerevan when he is there. But when he does head out, I think he has a very good relationship with the country and the fans. And I think that makes him a really genuine guy. And I think that's the main thing that people are drawn to him for.
Yeah, I agree. Well, for listeners who haven't seen the story, I mean, the way it works in the chess community, Sean, when an article like this shows up in the New Yorker, like I know there was a big profile on Magnus Carlsen, I want to say about 5 years ago, and, you know, it just gets shared everywhere on Facebook and on Twitter, and people just stop what they're doing and read it. So just want to thank you on behalf of the chess community. We love it when, you know, you give a well-balanced portrait of someone like Aroni and one of our best representatives. So any more chess writing in the pipeline, you think?
Well, I mean, one day I'd love to head out and really report on the feeder catastrophe or whatever you want to call it. That would be really cool in a kind of in-depth reporting kind of way. But yeah, there's a few ideas. Yeah, that could be a few books probably. But yeah, there's all sorts of things going on. I'm interested in the kind of the shift towards people playing in communities online and how that's changing the face of the game in many ways. And there are other players that I'd love to kind of speak to and maybe profile in the future, but we'll see. Yeah, this was a great story, and I'd love to do more on chess.
And did this inspire you to dig into like your own chess at all? You said you're not a very good player. Do you aspire to get better at all?
Well, I mean, I got a chess.com subscription and I gave that a go, and I was learning some things, and I read some articles and tried to play, but I'm still just about as useless as I was a couple of years ago. So I don't know if I'm going to really be playing much more in the future, but it's fascinating. And like I said, it's a real learning process. So yeah, I'll dip into it from time to time, but I'm always going to be completely rubbish.
So did you play tournaments at all when you were a kid, or just learn the rules basically?
Pretty much just learning the rules. And we had some kind of local champions that would turn up at the school and play some of the kids, and had some kind of inter-school tournaments, but really young at that point. So no, nothing beyond the odd, you know, few dozen games really. And then learning at home with my grandfather occasionally. But no, it was never like a major sport. I was playing all sorts of other sports at the time as well, so chess got pushed a bit back.
Nice. And how did the potential FIDE storyline that we'll be eagerly waiting for, how did that come on your radar? I know everyone in the chess world knows about the problems they've had, but outside of the chess world, I feel like it doesn't, thankfully, get that much attention.
Yeah, I mean, I actually had done my previous story for the New Yorker on corruption in Russian soccer.
Yeah, I checked that article. I mean, I read it. I quite enjoyed it. I dug in a little bit. Go on. You can tell the listeners.
Yeah, I think it was a story of a really famous old football club in Moscow that basically has fallen on really hard times. And one of the presidents or directors of the club at the moment is a very close friend of Vladimir Putin, who's actually been in the news quite a bit recently with all the stuff that's going on with you guys and the Russians.
Right.
But I just found that sort of reporting that story really fascinating. And I was looking into any other sort of weird sporting stories from Russia, essentially, and stumbled upon the FIDE thing.
Google. Googled corrupt organizations and up came FIDE.
Pretty much, yeah. That's yeah, funny. Yeah. And then I'm going to pronounce his name wrong, but your FIDE president, he is one hell of a character. And if I could do a story on him one day and the sort of what's going on in Kalmykia and with the Federation, then that would be a very, very fun, interesting investigation to do.
Yeah.
And I'm sure there's millions of reams of stuff that's yet to be written about that whole thing. So, yeah, maybe one day I can dig into that as well.
Excellent. Yeah. I feel like he may have gotten the New Yorker treatment once, but I think it was many years ago, and I could be wrong about where it was. Like where it was published.
I can't remember. I remember reading one kind of meaty feature about it a while back, but yeah, it would be interesting to see what he's up to at the moment, probably complaining about ghosts or whatever else he believes in.
Yeah, so on that soccer article, I lived in St. Petersburg in 1998, and I'm pretty sure Spartak was terrible now at that point. But they've become a powerhouse since then?
Yeah, they seem to be the best club in Russia at the moment. It's really weird in Russian football because so much is in flux and depends on kind of which benefactor is giving which club the most money. And at the moment, it seems to be Zenit St. Petersburg and Spartak are sort of racing ahead, while Dynamo and other clubs, including the ones from Dagestan and elsewhere in the North Caucasus, they're benefactors have run out of money and they've fallen on hard times. So Russian football is a bit of a lottery these days, and it really reflects on the country and its economy, which is another reason why looking into sport is so interesting, because a lot of the time it focuses on a country's economy and you can learn so much from that kind of stuff.
Yeah, for sure. I mean, soccer, I never know which to call it on this podcast. I feel like Americans should just give up the ghost and call it football, but unfortunately we have our own football, so it's a tough call. But anyway, soccer, aka football, with the World Cup coming up in Russia, are you a fan as well?
I'm a huge fan. I go to games whenever I can, and I support a very poor club at the moment back in London as well. So, yeah, I'll be watching every game pretty much. And I've got several friends that are in the football hierarchy in Russia, so I'm very keen to see how they stage that event. There's been a lot of talk of hooliganism and problems with violence, so which I think are mostly inflated by Western media that doesn't really understand Russia that well. But yeah, it's going to be really interesting to see how that pans out. I'm hoping to go there as well, so that'll be fun if it can happen.
Yeah, I'm sure there'll be a million behind the scenes story angles you could dig into.
I kind of conjure up a new one every day. Probably most of them are rubbish, but yeah, there's no shortage of stuff to write about that.
Yeah, and who's your pick to win next year?
Ooh, I mean, it's hard to look past Germany, really. They just look so solid at the moment. Brazil and Argentina look pretty shaky, so I'd probably rule them out. I'd love to say England will do well, but we're not going to do well. So I think to look past Germany, no, not really. I think it's going to probably be them in the final with someone else. But
and as a Berlin resident, do you root for them?
Yeah, sure. And when they beat Brazil 7-1 in the last tournament, that was pretty incredible. So that was there was a lot of street parties and stuff going on in the streets of Berlin. Actually, I wasn't here for the final, unfortunately. I was back in the States with my in-laws. But it was really, really great fun. And I'm sure they're going to do well this year. I mean, the Germans have an incredible mentality for sport. So they're really not going to screw up that many times. So I'd expect them to see that there or thereabouts.
Nice. Yeah. I'm a casual soccer fan, but the World Cup always gets my attention. So I'm excited for that.
Yeah. And you guys, I mean, I think you guys could do pretty well as well. You've got a good team at the moment. So we'll see what happens there.
Nice. We could use some good news. So what's your next story, Sean? Do you have it lined up?
I'm actually heading out to, I'm doing a more political story. I'm heading out to the Philippines in September. And I'm going to be writing about the country's drug war. So a bit of a departure from chess, but, I went there last year and I did a story for the New Republic on it, and how technology is playing a role in the violence there. So I'm going to head back, and kind of do a story on how things have panned out a year after I was last there. So that's going to be quite a different sort of story, but very rich and interesting thing to research as well, kind of history of the country.
Nice. So it seems like you've kind of settled into basically a few beats, right? You've got the Filipino beat and soccer beat. And
yeah, I mean, any story is a good story if it's good. I mean, I don't really necessarily follow a single thread at a time. I just I love kind of long form writing and really digging into a topic. So, yeah, whichever thing takes my fancy, I dive into it and seem to spend months and months looking at it.
Nice. Well, if you need some levity, or at least maybe not levity, but at least something a little less consequential, you could dig into Wesley So's history in the Philippines. They've got their own, you know, powerhouse chess culture, and he's got an interesting backstory there.
Yeah, I was thinking about getting in touch with a few people, actually. So maybe that's something I could do just kind of a story about while I'm there, yeah.
Nice. Well, Sean, I only have one or two more questions. I usually ask my guests for chess book recommendations, but I think in this case, you being the first full-time writer we've had on, I'd rather open it up to just anything generally. Any general book recommendations for our listeners? Anything that grabbed you?
Yeah, well, there's a book actually that I read quite recently that's by a guy called David Graham. He's written for all kinds of magazines. I think he might be a New Yorker staffer, actually. And he wrote a book recently called Killers of the Flower Moon. And it's about a kind of community of Native Americans in Oklahoma in the 1920s that were killed off for their oil. And my wife is from Oklahoma, so I have quite... I like reading about the state, and it's a really interesting historical nonfiction book. So yeah, that's what I'd recommend.
Excellent. Thank you. And do you have any general advice? I mean, there's a bit of a connection between chess players and writers. I mean, both of them are often pursued like alone in a room. So I think that chess players can get, not quite as obsessive, but I have noticed that a lot of people who like chess like writing. So do you have any general advice about writing or storytelling for our audience?
One would be stay off social media as much as you can.
I saw you had a tweet looking for some support with that.
Yeah, I got off Facebook recently. It's about the best thing I've done in a long time. That is something that I would recommend. But I don't know if it's just because I'm kind of researching all sorts of different topics. No, it's not necessarily something that I'm coming from a personal background kind of angle, but I just really speak to as many different people as you possibly can. It seems like such an obvious thing to say, but you really don't get a true insight of any topic. You know, you can read a million books, but until you speak to people about it that are involved, you don't really know everything about it. So that would be, I guess that would be my main bit of advice.
Excellent advice. Okay. Well, Sean, thanks a lot for coming on the podcast. Hopefully you'll keep the chess writing coming. I know that these things take a while to come to fruition, but we'll be looking forward to your writing in the future.
Thank you. It's a pleasure. Pleasure speaking to you, Ben.
And if anyone wants to reach out to you, what's the best way?
Oh, well, you know, as much as I said, I'm not on social media. I do have a Twitter handle. So, I'm at S. Williams Journo on Twitter. So people can reach out to me there. I'm pretty responsive.
Excellent. So I'll link to your Twitter account and to the article, although I suspect most of our listeners will have read it by the time this comes out. Okay. Well, thanks a lot, Sean. We really appreciate you putting in some good words for chess, and keep up the good work.
Thanks very much. Cheers.
Thanks for listening to Perpetual Chess. To hear more episodes, give feedback, or suggest guests, go to perpetualchesspod.com. If you like the show, please help me out by telling your friends and giving me a high rating on iTunes. I'll be back next week with another episode of the Perpetual Chess Podcast.
Sports Social Podcast Network.
With Lucky Land Slots, you can get lucky just about anywhere.
This is your captain speaking. We've got clear runway and the weather's fine, but we're just going to circle up here a while and get lucky. No, nothing like that. It's just these cash prizes add up quick. So I suggest you sit back, keep your tray table upright, and start getting lucky.
Play for free at LuckyLandSlots.com. Are you feeling lucky? No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18+ terms and conditions apply. See website for details.